Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 12th. Today's session is entitled Poetry in the Bible, Judas and Peter, presented by Kathy Schwinn, number SCK-2006-07. Let's listen in.
Hello. Welcome. I'm so glad that you're all here on this rainy, rainy evening. Hans, come in and grab a Bible.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah. Oh, here comes some more people. Eunice, feel free to grab a Bible on your way in. And pass one, and maybe for Martha as well.
Does that mean grab a Bible?
Yes.
It doesn't
order. Yes. Well, it was the Holden lingo of telling you to do something. Please feel free.
Yeah.
Grab a Bible.
Please do this. Right?
Please, yes. At your earliest convenience, it would be really nice if you could.
I don't grab Bibles.
You delicately pick them up from their resting places.
Yes.
Wonderful. Well, grab a Bible, you guys. Did you like how I just?
Yeah, she's incorrigible.
Now I'm learning assertiveness. Well, welcome. My name is Kata Schwain, and when I'm not here at Holden, I live in Iowa City, where I just finished graduate work at the University of Iowa and getting an MFA in creative writing. And this next year, I will have the joy and delight of getting to do some teaching at Augustana College in Rock Island, Illinois, where some other brilliant people who I've gotten to meet this week are also teaching, which is exciting for me. So today, we're going to look hopefully at two poems, one for sure, which this summer just became just a favorite poem, and I hope I get through it without crying. It's great. So I'm excited to get to share it and to get to hear your thoughts about it. And excited that there's people in the room that are going to know more about the biblical context than I will, because that's not my expertise. We'll start out by reading two versions of the story of Judas in the Bible and do some just sort of general brainstorming about what is the difference between these two versions of the story. We won't get too in-depth into that, just pretty quickly. Then we'll look at a poem called St. Judas by James Wright that I'll pass out to you. And we'll look at another poem that deals with Peter if there's time. But in the case of both poems, what I want to be thinking about, sort of in the backs of your brains that we'll return to at the end, is what is the poem trying to get us to think about in terms of our understanding of Judas in this case? What are our assumptions, and what things is it challenging about our assumptions? Okay, that's kind of the first layer. And the second layer is this sort of revisioning useful? And if it is, what ways is it useful? And could it be dangerous, potentially? And what ways potentially could it be dangerous? So just sort of have that stewing in the back of your minds. Does that sort of make sense where we're going here? Yeah? Okay. So two wonderful people have volunteered to read. And let's get, first we're going to look at Matthew 27, verses 3 through 10. So let's give people a second to get there. And then tell me your name again.
Karen.
Karen is going to read for us.
The suicide of Judas. When Judas, his betrayer, saw that Jesus was condemned, he repented and brought back the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and the elders. He said, "I have sinned by betraying innocent blood." But they said, "What is that to us? See it to yourself." Throwing down the pieces of silver in the temple, he departed, and he went and hanged himself. But the chief priests, taking the pieces of silver, said, "It is not lawful to put them into the treasury, since they are blood money." After conferring together, they used them to buy the potter's field as a place to bury foreigners. For this reason, that field has been called the field of blood to this day. Then he fulfilled what had been spoken through the prophet Jeremiah. And they took the 30 pieces of silver, the price of the one on whom the price had been set, on whom some of the people of Israel had set a price, and they gave them for the potter's field, as the Lord commanded me.
Great. Thank you, Karen. Okay, and now let's turn to Acts chapter 1, verses 15 through 20, and maybe just give people a second to get there, and then and tell me your name.
Anne.
Anne's volunteered bravely to read this one. And other Anne, you might want a Bible. Go ahead.
In those days, Peter stood up among the believers. Together, the crowd numbered about 120 persons and said, "Friends, the scripture had to be fulfilled, which the Holy Spirit through David foretold concerning Judas, who became a guide for those who arrested Jesus. For he was numbered among us and was allotted his share in this ministry. Now, the man acquired a field with the reward of his wickedness, and falling headlong, he burst open in the middle, and all his bowels gushed out. This became known to all the residents of Jerusalem, so that the field was called in their language, Hakeldama, that is, field of blood."
Great. Thank you. So, just on a pretty superficial sort of plot-wise level, what's the difference between these two stories about Judas's death?
How he died.
How he died, and how did he die in, let's do the Matthew text first. I mean, just
hang
yourself. Mm-hmm. And how about in Acts?
That he falls headlong and his bowels spill everywhere.
Yeah, it's a little bit unclear exactly how it went down, but he fell headlong and his bowels gushed out, okay.
It sounds more Homeric.
Yeah, it does, kind of. And somebody mentioned that one is what self-inflicted versus accidental, right? Theoretically? Okay. What else do you notice? Anything?
That, it says he bought the field himself.
Right. Versus? Okay. This one. Judas buys. Priest spy. And so if this is the case, in both of the stories, how does Judas come across? What kind of guy is he? Just from this story alone, what's his character like in the Matthew story versus in the Acts story?
I think Matthew comes off better.
I
don't think he expected that they're going to kill him. I think he when he finds that out, he repents.
He repents. Okay. So in the Matthew story, he repents. And how about in the other one?
We don't know.
We don't know. As far as we know, he's chilling out in the field and falls headlong. Right? So versus, as far as we know, he's still in the place of being sort of greedy and filled with betrayal and stuff like that, right?
But it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, go ahead.
We say greedy, but in neither of the texts does it really say that he's greedy.
Okay.
And in the Matthew text, contrary to what you just had there, it says that he betrays him. Actually, in the Acts text, it says he guided him. It doesn't really use that betrayal.
You mean in relationship to Jesus?
Yeah. It says betrays Jesus in the Matthew text.
Okay, so the actual word betray is used here.
Yeah, but in the Acts text, it doesn't.
It says guides.
For those who, yeah. He became a guide for those who arrested Jesus.
So he becomes a guide.
Okay,
which
great.
Doesn't sound as sinister.
No, it sounds more helpful, in fact. But it also says in the Matthew text we get the word repent in there somewhere, don't we, mm-hmm. specifically? So he comes off in some ways in the Matthew text as a worse guy to begin with, but in the Matthew text he repents. So maybe there's a greater sort of range in terms of his changing. Would you say that's, I don't know, I'm just throwing that out.
Yeah, I think there's an inference in Acts, especially if you use the note about falling headlong, it says, or swelling up.
Ooh, interesting. I didn't have okay.
In the translation, that it wasn't accidental exactly. It was one of those just desserts that happens to somebody, that he was in the two parts of the sentence, the reward of his wickedness and swelling up, he...
Okay.
So that there's an inference that the swelling up of the exploding body is somehow a consequence of the wickedness.
Which is then inflicted by God, would you go for?
I say inferred, and I don't
okay.
know how any more than that. It offers us to connect
that. Connect that. Okay, I'll put a question. I'm going to put God inflicted question mark. But that somehow... that. Or he was deserving it, that somehow that fate was in there somehow. Great. This is wonderful. These are the main things that I sort of wanted to get up there. Obviously, we could talk about these two stories for an entire Bible study and more, but because I wouldn't be able to help you that much, let's do one to every two people here. I'm not, and then if we have extras, we can, oh, and we've got some upstairs.
Okay.
Well, no. I thought you wouldn't be able to see the poem. Okay.
Do you want me to
do you? Would you mind, Eunice?
Oh, I'm like that.
I know you are. Are you? No, I think she's not gonna. Yes.
Same
no,
same
I don't
steps.
Think so.
Okay.
Oh. No, she just wanted one up for upstairs. Okay, we're gonna wait for. Maybe it's easier to go out this way?
It's not easier, it's
yeah, I think that's the only way to go upstairs.
Okay. Can everybody see one at this point or no? In the back, you guys can't? Do you wanna just. Is there an extra? She's gonna bring more, but just for reading through it the first time. How many have read James Wright before? Familiar with him? He's usually anthologized. He's fairly well known. Was in Minnesota for some time. Okay. I'm going to read it through once, and then someone can volunteer to read it through again so we hear it twice. Saint Judas. When I went out to kill myself, I caught a pack of hoodlums beating up a man. Running to spare his suffering, I forgot my name, my number, how my day began, how soldiers milled around the garden stone and sang amusing songs, how all that day their javelins measured crowds, how I alone bargained the proper coins and slipped away. Banished from heaven, I found this victim beaten, stripped, kneed, and left to cry. Dropping my rope aside, I ran, ignored the uniforms. Then I remembered bread my flesh had eaten, the kiss that ate my flesh. Flayed without hope, I held the man for nothing in my arms. Who else would read it so we could hear it again?
Carol's bringing it down.
Oh, wonderful.
We'll have another sip.
Is there somebody else who would be willing to read it so we can hear it again? Kimberly?
Oh. When I went out to kill myself, I caught a pack of hoodlums beating up a man. Running to spare his suffering, I forgot my name, my number, how my day began. How soldiers milled around the garden stone and sang amusing songs. How all that day their javelins measured crowds. How I alone bargained the proper coins and slipped away. Banished from heaven, I found this victim beaten, stripped, kneed, and left to cry. Dropping my rope aside, I ran, ignored the uniforms. Then I remembered bread my flesh had eaten, the kiss that ate my flesh, played without hope. I held the man for nothing in my arms.
Okay, here's some extra copies. People want their own copy. Okay, so. As we kind of go, we're going to go through this poem really slowly now. And as we go through, line by line, phrase by phrase, I want to propose that we keep an eye out for simultaneity. That is, things that are happening at the same time. Or things that push our interpretation in two different directions at once. Eunice has been doing some great step sessions about storytelling and versions of stories and how things happened. And already in the Bible, right, we have two different versions of what happened to Judas. So thinking about how might certain parts of those versions be played out in here, and just as a general overview, what this is a sonnet, and it's a Petrarchian sonnet, so we have an octave followed by a sestet, 8 lines followed by 6 lines. And generally when you have a Petrarchan sonnet, there's that turn in the middle, which is marked by a white space here, and that means that there's going to be a shift in the way that the speaker is arguing that point, or a shift in the viewpoint, that something's going to shift there, okay? And what I'd like to propose, and then people can argue against me, I forgot to say that at the beginning, that this is a Holden discussion, so all viewpoints are not only welcomed, but sort of necessary for us to have a good discussion about this. So what I want to propose is that we're getting the same speaker telling us the story twice. And I want to focus on how does the speaker's version change the second time he tells it? Or does it change at all? Does that sort of make sense? Can be looking for? Okay. So let's just start with the title. I mean, what do you guys notice about the title? What's weird about the title? Yeah. Well, do you think, and I don't know the answer to this, I mean, what are the ways to read that? If you were going to title a poem Saint Judas, what's sort of the tone of voice of someone who would title it that, do you think?
Maybe kind of facetious.
Okay.
Or daring.
Okay. That's great. So either it could be facetious or ironic, like St. Judas, like, yeah, right? And what could follow might be ironic. Or it might be daring or sincere, or here we go, I'm going to give you a new interpretation of this man that's going to convince you that he is a saint, right? So already, before we even start the poem, we're not quite sure what the tone is, right? We're a little bit off balance already. Okay, so then we get this first line. Let's see. We'll go the first 2 lines. When I went out to kill myself, I caught a pack of hoodlums beating up a man. What do you guys notice about those first 2 lines?
Someone else did it.
Okay, so he is an observer of a crime. Okay, anything else?
Just the opening, sort of like, I was on the store to get some butter. I'm on my way to kill myself.
Great.
As a matter of fact.
Very wonderful. So we have a speaker who's very matter of fact and very blunt. Like, right in the first half of the first sentence, or the first line, you get that he's on his way to kill himself. It's just right out there. And what about, based on the first 2 lines, and there's not a specific answer I'm looking for here, what time period would you say that we're in? Without the title, yeah.
He's using the vernacular.
Okay. Hoodlums, yes. Oh, say it again.
I said he's using current vernacular with the pack of hoodlums.
Pack of hoodlums, great.
So it would be now, present day, not back then.
And who do you assume that the I is?
Who knows,
okay. Who else could it be?
Well, it's confusing because if it's Judas, he's telling it as if he didn't kill himself.
Okay.
And he's still alive to tell it.
Okay.
So that time frame is confusing.
So already, the title is St. Judas, so you kind of want to, usually our first inclination with the poem is sort of to, if the title is like that, to read the I immediately as Judas. But already, he's telling a story about killing himself, but if he's telling it, we assume he hasn't succeeded, and that would go against our interpretation. That's great.
Or he can speak from beyond the grave.
Or he can speak from beyond the grave. Wonderful.
Or he's still on his, he's just like a little little sidebar. He's still on his way to kill himself, but this is what happened.
This is what happened that sort of paused him, okay? So those three versions, now this is getting weirder because now we don't know whether Judas is alive in the process of killing himself or dead and speaking to us from beyond the grave. I mean, that's usually when we begin a poem, we're pretty sure what kind of speaker we're dealing with. So again, shaky ground. Okay, what else? Anything? How about, do we know either who, at this point, the pack of hoodlums or the man is?
The man could be Judas.
The man could be Judas, okay.
The narrator could be somebody.
The narrator could be somebody else. Great. Who else could, if we get the title St. Judas, what assumptions might we make about the hoodlums or the man?
We could assume the man is Jesus, and the hoodlums, especially since the hoodlums carry javelins, they could be...
But we don't know that yet.
Oh.
But at this point, but you're right. We still make that assumption, though, as, I don't know your name, but you pointed out that hoodlums is vernacular, and so although a couple lines later we're getting soldiers and javelins, the first impulse is to be in the present, the present day, more contemporary. So not only are we confused about where Judas is in the timeline of his life, but we're confused about whether is this a present day story, or is this a, you know, are we in the times of Jesus, right? Is, where are we going to be? Is there anything happening simultaneously in this first line or two?
Well, you've got someone that's resigned, but they're still active, and they still put the verb caught. You know,
Great. So he's resigned his life, but now he's about to act. And just very specifically, he's on his way to kill himself, and that's when he catches the pack. So it's two actions sort of happening at the same time in this first line, right? Does that make sense? More or less?
And there's kind of a parallel. He's going to kill himself and he's seeing this man maybe getting killed.
Right. So seeing the self in the one who's great. Okay, so running to spare his suffering, I forgot my name, my number, how my day began. Let's just do that. What do you guys notice about that?
Yeah, the number also sounds very modern.
Okay, why?
Yeah, I think my name and number, I think my name and phone number.
Okay.
I'm thinking prison number.
Yeah. You're thinking prison number? Okay. No, I think there's lots of... Is there, and maybe, I don't know, Bob or Ellie could, or somebody else, so is there, like, somebody was telling me at some point, and maybe this was total not nonsenseness, are there numerical equivalents for certain Hebrew, words and... Okay.
Sorry. Every Hebrew word has a numerical equivalent.
Okay, so theoretically your name also has a number?
Yeah.
Okay, so we've got prison number, we've got phone number that calls up contemporary stuff, we've got...
Well, another one that popped into my mind is the being that has a number in Scripture is the mark of the beast, and Judas being associated with evil.
Wonderful.
I don't know if that...
No, that's, I think all of them are, but that's great.
I thought of the, you know, name, rank, and serial number. You're allowed to say if you're captured.
Right. But possessions that you own, that are with you always, to use the theme.
That was good.
Yeah, these are all
identity pieces, great. And how my day began, what does that start cluing us into in terms of where we are in time?
After the beginning of the day.
Yeah. After the beginning of the day, right? So it's later on in the day.
Well, and what led to when I went out to kill myself.
Right. Yeah. So that what we're going to get as everything else starts unfolding, that his going out to kill himself definitely is happening on the same day that all of these... the other things that he's going to say happen, the betrayal and stuff like that. So we're dealing in that present day. Theoretically, if it's Judas that we're talking about. But again, that's up in the air. Okay, so I forgot my name, my number, how my day began, how soldiers milled around the garden stone and sang amusing songs, how all that day their javelins measured crowds, how I alone bargained the proper coins and slipped away. What do you guys notice there? Are we more sure about who the speaker is at this point? It's hard to read it as somebody other than Judas when we get bargained the proper coins and slipped away. I would think, though, if somebody else wants to make an argument against that, what do you think? People feel pretty sure that it's Judas, yeah?
Well, Judas bargained with someone.
Okay.
So there are two people exchanging money.
Okay.
So theoretically, how I alone, or I alone of all the others, bargained the proper coins, isn't the person who dealt with Judas. I'm not proposing that, but there's always two.
There's always two. Okay, so there's somebody on the other side.
There's only one.
And it's kind of interesting. Here he's bargaining. It sounds like it must be with the soldiers. That's not what the text says.
That's not what the text says.
And then my mind slips to who's the one that was there around soldiers and got away. Mm-hmm. Not Judas.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Peter.
Yeah. So, right, so, okay, so things are being more confused here in terms of blame and fault and who's, you know, Ingrid saying somebody else that could be bargained with, Bob saying Pete, there's sort of almost Peter references here, and although it's sort of titled St. Judas, and so at some level we're probably going to read that as the narrator throughout, it certainly isn't. If you choose a given moment in the poem, it's not necessarily clear that that's who it is. There's some sort of fluctuation a little bit.
Before we go on,
yes.
What about the garden stone?
Yeah, can you say, does anybody know what, I don't know. I assume that garden is referring to Gethsemane, yeah?
Well,
the tomb.
In Protestant,
like in the garden. Oh, yeah, yeah.
There are two tombs of Jesus. There's the one in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and then there's the garden tomb outside the walls of the old city.
Okay.
And what I understood by looking at this was that soldiers were milling around the stone that was rolled across the garden tomb. They were outside Jesus' grave.
Outside the grave. Okay. I think that's a way better.
Well, that's a biblical reference. That actually says that they posted guards.
Okay.
The use of the word mill is interesting in relation to stone, because you use a stone to mill grain.
Yes.
And so this milling, I mean, it's just interesting.
Yes.
It's the same shape of stone, and it's actually across those tubes. It's a round, flat.
It's the same shape as,
yeah.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
And then the use of the word amusing, which is such a light and fancy word for, they're not like vulgar songs or ugly songs, they're
no.
Amusing songs.
And there's something about, you know, milling around, the milling around sort of factor that also seems sort of light and airy.
It seems in contrast to the violence of the story.
But I was thinking that they were milling around for the, before the, into the evening, they were ready to get Judas. So that there were a lot of people that were knowing what this day was going to come to.
Okay.
And maybe one of them, some of them were doing this coin exchange too, but that there was, it was coming to something by the evening.
So could the milling around the stone have, and maybe you guys can, have happened before the stone was, I mean, while Jesus is still on the cross and they're getting ready to put the body in the tomb?
No,
so the stone hasn't yet been...
That's happened until after.
That's another story.
You can't have Jesus on the cross, but he hasn't even killed himself yet.
Right, well, I'm saying we can't have... Well, the soldiers can't be milling around... I mean, Jesus hasn't been killed
yet.
Right, so we can't say that... When
it doesn't say on the day I killed myself. It's the day I went from myself. So...
Well, in the Bible, though, Judas hangs himself before Jesus is crucified. So, in Matthew. So if we're following the Matthew text, if the poet is specifically then the soldiers are milling around the garden stone that isn't yet being used to block off the tomb. It's just being used as being about to be blocked off, right?
There.
Is that it's
there,
there
but it hasn't been used for that.
Okay. So, which is...
Why would they be there?
The stone is there because it's in readiness for to receive the body for the grave. That's part of the
that wasn't decided
apparatus, till, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. That wasn't decided until after the crucifixion.
But I'm saying these graves were hewn out and stones, I mean, regardless
right.
of who's
right.
going
so
in
even
there,
if,
so, the stone's got to
so
be
maybe
ready.
They're
un,
they're not knowing
that.
That.
Yeah.
It's like
right.
part of the funerary arrangements.
Right.
My guess is this is a yet another version of the story.
Of the story. Mm-hmm. I think that's right.
That,
and
that Judas is, in this version, kills himself after Jesus was buried. I mean, it's not... It's a self-contained unit. It's not doesn't necessarily
so
have
they follow
to
either of these.
Yeah.
Because
and I think
is there, I don't remember, but is there a part where Judas sees the guy getting beat? No.
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 Right,
so that's
no.
entirely creative. And I think in some ways as we go through it that maybe that some of the details in terms of how closely it relates to the Matthew. Might be important in terms of how are we comparing these things, but mostly I want to worry about how does this version change our idea of the character of Judas more than how is it dealing with like the nitpicky details of the, you know, of the timeline exactly, except to say that it is important to say that if this is a different version probably of what happened in terms of events. That's good to know.
Well, as far as like, go ahead.
Oh, well, you skipped over the part about running to spare his suffering, which
yes.
he went along with what you said about the cut, that he's actively involved. And this shows a person of compassion and caring,
yes.
not the selfish so-and-so that we have always been led to believe Judas was. That,
great.
You know, he was thinking always in terms of his own gain and what was in it for me.
Right. So this is about gestures of compassion.
Yeah, not just gestures, but he's running to spare the suffering. He's willing to get actively involved between these hoodlums and the guy who's being beaten up.
Mm-hmm.
That's not our Judas.
Right. And again, and I think that it's good that you bring attention to that line because, again, we have two things running to spare his suffering. I mean, it's two things happening at once. I mean, he's clearly running as an action to get to the person who he's going to spare the suffering of, but it's similar to the, when I went out to kill myself, I caught. You know, like, I'm running in order to do this other thing. There's two actions that are being balanced simultaneously.
It's also a juxtaposition of his action created Christ's suffering.
And now he's the one, yes.
Yeah, he is evading somebody else's.
Great. Yeah.
I think the interesting contrast between the actions in the first three lines, you know, catching and running, and what these soldiers are doing, which is milling, singing, and measuring.
Mm-hmm.
And it, the whole thing, I didn't really pay attention to the garden stone thing, but the whole thing about soldiers milling around, singing amazing songs, measuring crowds, I think just says there's a whole lot of people in this story for whom this story has no significance.
Okay. Great.
They're just doing their job.
So all of those verbs are in contrast to Judas's action. We also have those other
yeah,
people in the background.
Yeah, he's really deeply involved in something, starting with his deciding to kill himself, and then the things that transpire from there. And then there's these people who are just there,
uh-huh.
not invested.
Not invested in the story at all.
Extras.
And then I wonder if some of those are us.
Okay.
I guess I read this very simply, and it's a simple mind here, but when I read this, I see the man who's being beaten up as Jesus.
Uh-huh. I
and
think
I don't
yeah.
see that this eight lines is necessarily in a very short time span. And so the timing of the particular lines as to what we understand the sequence of events for mm-hmm. is not that important to me. I see these the soldiers and Jesus as man beaten up and he Judas betrays him by, I don't think he even thought he was betraying, he pointed him out, but I don't think he realized that it was going to go as far as it was. So you got it went as far as it was, and then he's going to kill himself. He's feeling bad, and then when he's there, he sees them beating up. I see them beating up either the Pharisees and that who beat him up legally or the actual killing of him, and all these things going ding, bing, 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 bing. But it could be over a period, a longer period of time. So I guess I just simply, I just, this just is another way of telling the story. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I don't know if that gets us anywhere. But I see the soldiers, and I see the people going around, and I see the stone, and I see the gardeners. But it doesn't necessarily have to be within a compressed
amount of time.
Time frame.
It's You're not right.
Over this period of time.
Well, and I think to mention the sort of flash, flash, flash action of it is correct, because what actually, in this first stanza here, in the first eight lines, if you're seeing this as like a movie, and our figure is Judas or the Eye or whatever, who's running to the man, what actually happens in the first eight lines? What actions actually take place? What do you see?
The only verb is caught.
Yep.
And
running to spare his suffering.
Saw, not he didn't grab the ring.
That he's in the process of going out, whatever that means, and he caught, but in this case caught is seeing, right? He sees, and he starts to run over, and then what is the entire rest of the stanza?
Flashbacks.
It's all about I forgot, and then boom, 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 boom. So all of these flash, all of the rest of the images are simply in his mind. It's not part of the scene that we're seeing. But Bob, you had your hand.
The other thing I tried to think of is biblical allusions or stories where people come to the aid of people who are beaten. The most famous one is the Good Samaritan.
Yes.
And so Judas the Good Samaritan. That sounds like a
Wonderful. So it's pointing not just to the story, it's pointing to other Bible stories as well.
Maybe.
And probably also, if we're assuming that, also how about, what comes to mind for me too is also, you know, Jesus' words about, you know, I am in the, when I was hungry, and when you saw somebody who was hungry and you gave them bread, that was me. You know, all of those things. So that even if this man isn't Jesus, that based on Jesus' teaching, whoever the man is, it is Jesus, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah? So in some ways it doesn't matter if it specifically is, but it's interesting. And time is goes so fast. Okay, so let's move on. I know we could keep spending all this time on this one even, but so let's start now the last six lines and think about it. I like to think that in that space he's like regrouping and is like, okay, I'm going to start the story again. Where does he start it this time?
When he has reached the victim.
Okay, but what's the first phrase?
Banished
from heaven.
So back to the reason why he's going to kill himself.
Right, okay, so instead of telling you, when I went out to kill myself, he starts with banished from heaven. So what's the difference between saying those two things?
He's probably feeling forsaken.
He's feeling forsaken. Great. So we're getting theological context immediately instead of just, I'm going out to kill myself. It's all of a sudden really loaded. Banished from heaven. This isn't just a decision that I'm making. It's one that, you know, I have been excluded from heaven. Does that make sense? So we're starting, it's already a different beginning. But then, as Ellie was saying, then where does it go next?
Before you go next, the sort of passiveness of it, it's not that, not that he's lost heaven himself, but that he's kind of, it's happened to him. And then I think back to the text that we read, where both of the texts, I think, say, this is the fulfill of the prophecy that says such and such is going to happen.
Okay.
So he might be feeling like he has no control over it.
Okay, so it's something, so the way that it's phrased makes it seem like it's an outside power putting this upon him rather than it's something that's come out of him. Great. And then, as Ellie said, we get right into, I found, and what's the difference between I found this victim beaten versus I caught a pack of hoodlums beating up a man? What's the focus of the attention?
The victim.
Yeah. Because in the...
More like the
good scenario. Right. And you don't, I mean, to me, I don't even realize, until I get to the second version, I don't even realize that in the first version, his attention is on the pack of hoodlums that's doing the beating up. It's in the second version, we get banished from heaven, and then immediately, I found this victim. You know, it's the focus on the suffering person. I found this victim beaten, stripped, kneed, and left to cry. What do you guys notice about that compared to the first one? Yes. Why? I don't know. Why?
What does it mean to be kneed?
Well, I think... But go ahead. What else could it mean?
Well, it's humbled like bread.
So there's an actual that kind of kneading in? Mm-hmm. Yep, great.
That would be with an N-E-A-B, but if you're on your knees, could be kneed.
Yep. But I think it's always, I mean, whenever you have, all right, is it homonyms, words that are, is that the word? Yes?
It sounds the same.
Okay, that sounds the same, but they're spelled different. I mean, you know, I always believe that both of those meanings get knit up in there. I mean, we only have so many words here, and they're chosen pretty carefully.
Does the person banished from heaven necessarily have to be Judas? What if it's the man? The man is, by his being beaten or maybe killed for some reason, is banished for heaven, and then he takes off and dropping my rope. Dropping everything that he was doing,
I'm confused. Wait, well, who's the...
Well, banished from heaven. I'm going to assume that's Judas. Could that be somebody else? Maybe not. Maybe it has to be Judas, but...
what if it's the victim that's banished?
Grammatically, the I is who is finding the victim is
the one
who
is banished from heaven.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's that setup of, here's this, you can't be resigned. From heaven, but you're actually found.
Yes.
So you're
great. So we have the thing that's similar from the previous one is holding these two things at the same time. I'm banished, but I'm in the act of finding at the same time. And being asked to hold those two. I mean, I think it's really important that this poet is consistently asking us as readers to hold two things at once. We have to hold the banishment and his finding and tending to this other person, right, in the same line.
Is there not a parallel between I went to kill myself and banished from heaven? Because at least in Catholic theology, are suicides banished from heaven?
Yep. And so that the banished from heaven...
Not anymore, though.
Not anymore?
No. But that it isn't banished necessarily for having betrayed Jesus, but banished for the suicide.
So it could be for the act he's about to commit or for the act he's already committed. That's unclear. Great. But again, I think Eunice's question is a good one. I found this victim beaten, stripped, kneed, and left to cry. Now, if it was the Good Samaritan story, we'd get left to die, right? I mean, we usually get left to die by the side of the road, but here we just get left to cry, and... I mean, I don't know the answer to this. Any thoughts?
It lessens, to a certain extent, the act of the eye narrowing. This person's going to live.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not saving their life.
Mm-hmm.
They're just providing comfort.
Okay.
The narrator is strictly providing comfort, not saving their life. So.
Okay.
What about crying because of what he's done?
Of that the victim is...
Yeah.
Okay.
The victim is crying because he's done something bad.
Well, I was kind of wondering,
could it be Jesus crying, Father, why have you forsaken me?
Okay, brings up that. I don't know the answer to that for sure, but I think it's really it's an interesting choice. I also want to point out that this is a smaller thing, but just to hear it really strong, I mean, sonnets are written in iambic pentameter, and so you get, when I went out to kill myself, I caught a pack of hoodlums beating up a man. I'm saying it in that so you can hear that you can say it that way.
But when we get stripped, kneed, and left to cry, that totally breaks the rhythm. You're getting, so it's not, I mean, poems, I think, at their best are not just a mental experience at all. It's a physical experience that happens to us. And so when the poet is saying that this guy has been stripped, kneed, and left to cry, and he's breaking out of the rhythm to do that, we're feeling that as a forced rhythm upon us. So that's felt. Okay, so then we get, dropping my rope aside, I ran, ignored the uniforms. What's the difference? Any differences noticed between that and the first version?
Yeah, the hoodlums have become uniforms.
Yes. Yeah. Yep. What else? Anything?
Why are they being, why? There's soldiers running around.
Yeah,
well, the soldier, in the first version, we have soldiers, but those are in his memory. And now this time, the hoodlums have become soldiers, or have become someone dressed in uniform.
Also, he's named how he plans to kill himself. I dropped my rope.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Great.
And this time he's ignoring the uniforms as opposed to focusing on them.
Yes.
His memory. He's just...
Great. Great. So this time, not only have we noticed already by the ordering that he's focused on the victim, but this is telling us specifically, I ignored the uniforms, I went straight for the victim. And then go ahead.
I was just going to say, a similarity between the first and the second stanza is this instinct of goodness,
mm-hmm.
in terms of running to spare his suffering and dropping my rope. It's like he's forgetting his own situation.
And going to the other.
Yes.
Wonderful. So that hasn't changed.
That has not.
Between the two, right.
But the tension is still there.
The tension, yep.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And you point the dropping, I ran, right, is
yes.
Running, I forgot. Doing this, I did this. Doing this, I did this, right? We're always, and then I love this, get the end of this line, a colon, which in, as a grammar tool is like an equal sign, right? That what comes before and what comes after are somehow equivalent. So we'll go back to that. But as we read the rest of this, think about how could these be different? How could this be an equation? Is it an equation? Or is that something that's getting messed with? So, then I remembered bread my flesh had eaten, the kiss that ate my flesh. How, talk about that. How is that different than how we maybe usually view those actions in the Bible?
He seems to be
referring to?
He seems to be recalling the Last Supper.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. In the bread, my flesh, and he
yeah.
was there.
Right. But usually when we talk about the Last Supper,
it's take this bread, my flesh.
Yes. Who's
Christ.
Right. And instead, somehow, that's being, it's being kind of inverted. Whose flesh are we focusing on?
Judas's.
Judas's.
Flesh ate the bread.
And it's just bread there. No, it's... So, then I remember bread my flesh had eaten, the kiss that ate my flesh. How about that?
Burn.
Yeah. Like acid or something, right? And what's the kiss? I mean, what's the kiss that ate...
Indication.
The betrayal, yeah.
It's like guilt.
And it's interesting, who's the action of kissing that's a betrayal against Jesus, you know, he's kissing Jesus' flesh, but whose flesh is being eaten away?
His.
So again, in both of those phrases, it's kind of a reversal of whose flesh is being eaten. In both instances, you know, it's interesting. Anybody want to say anything else sort of about, okay, how about in terms of, in the first section we get, I forgot, and in this section what do we get?
Ignored.
I remembered. I ignored, great, I ignored the uniforms, and then I remembered, right? And although in the first stanza he says, I forgot, we still get all of his memories, right? So he might be forgetting, but it's helping us remember since we didn't know it. So in the poem itself, it's doing the same activity. Both the remembering and the forgetting does the same thing for us as a reader. But for the eye, it's a remembering. It's a not trying to forget what happened. It's a purposefully, I'm going to remember this. I'm going to hold on to what I have done. As I'm running over to do this great act of kindness, what am I thinking about? I'm thinking about how badly I screwed up, right? That he's going to be doing both of those things at once. And then we get this last line that I just... Flayed without hope, I held the man for nothing in my arms. Yeah.
So do you think too that the whole thing is just he was just focused in doing this and all this stuff happened around him as he was getting to the very end?
Yeah.
How do you do
that? Yeah, that's going to be my next question. The for nothing, the phrase for nothing. I held the man for nothing. What are the different ways to read that?
Well, that's why I thought the left to cry. I mean, he wasn't going to save this person's life.
Okay.
This is just this person's going to live. He's got beat up, he's going to live. There's no reason. It's not going to affect his salvation.
Okay, it's not going to affect Judas's salvation. So.
It's not going to affect the life of the guy.
Yep.
It's just a,
and in that tub. Sense, what does it mean? If you're to the point where you believe you have no access to heaven no matter what you do, and in that moment what you choose to do is to care for the other, you know, that what else does for nothing bring up for people?
No payment.
The what?
No payment.
No payment, no silver coins, right? Brings back the bargaining from the first. And also just the for nothing that the man, if he, you know, if you read the other part as though he's almost dead because he's beaten close to the end of his life, that the man is almost to the point of being for nothing. I held the man for nothing. Like he was almost gone, but he's going to go and hold him anyway. Even though he's not going to be able to save the person, he's still going to go and comfort him.
And could the man be Jesus?
Great. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. And the flayed too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I have trouble with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Why?
I can't make sense of the reference. Flayed.
What is that?
Okay. Flayed.
Healed.
Because I went and looked it up to make sure I had all of the. Because I think it is such a key. I mean, it's such a strong verb right there, right? Mm-hmm. So flayed can either be to strip off the skin or surface of something, or to criticize harshly, or to lash.
The scourging of Jesus is called.
It's
done with a flail.
Okay.
I think.
Great. No, I didn't know that.
So it's you saw the Passion of the Christ. Unfortunately for you, that's flayed.
Okay.
What
so what's been physically done to Jesus is essentially that Judas is feeling that metaphorically.
Like,
some
way. Well, the first time you read through it, I heard it as like the speaker is flayed without hope.
Yeah.
But maybe it's not grammatically correct, but you could think of it as I held the man who was flayed without hope for nothing in my arms.
Uh-huh. Though I think in the case, just like with the banished from heaven, I think you're right because the line break is there, and so you don't know till the next line who it is that's going to be flayed without hope, and so that forces both of those readings there. I think that's right. And I think, I mean, if the idea of flaying is also to criticize harshly, who's been criticized really harshly that we can think of from this poem? Judas, right? Yeah.
Well, I read, and I can't remember what the source was, that Judas was a zealot and that his hope in betraying Christ was that he was going to force his hand to reveal himself as the messianic king and drive out the Romans. That was what the zealots wanted. They wanted a political victory.
Okay.
And they thought by forcing his hand, he would display his
his might and overcome the Romans and establish the kingdom on earth. That he did not mean it to turn out as it had, as it did turn out, because he thought for sure that Christ was going to be victorious on this earth.
Okay.
So then that would explain his loss of hope.
Right, that's what I'm saying about this.
And we don't have the resurrection or anything yet, and at this point in time, the man is just a man and he's dead.
Exactly.
And for everything that he did, if not even when he tried to help, it didn't. Nothing. He held him for no reason.
Yeah.
He sold him out and nothing did came of it. It was for nothing.
And so then we go back. You get to the end of poems, I think, and always wanna, it's a good poem, you always wanna go back to the beginning. And we go back to the beginning and are confronted with St. Judas again. And this time, how do we read the title? Yeah. Is it, I mean, are we wondering, like, is this an ironic title at this point? Probably not, right? But it quest, I mean, I think it can bring up our notions of what makes a saint, right? What makes somebody saintly or have that quality about them? And, but let's, we have maybe like 2 or 3 minutes here yet. I want to hear final thoughts about this, what other reasons why it's moving or not moving to you, but also I think we've talked a little bit about ways that this is a revisioning of Jesus maybe too, of Judas. And I love poems that deal with the Bible. They're sort of my favorite things to work with, spoken from biblical characters. At the end, I always ask, because I don't know, what do we do with them? When we go back and read the story of Judas now, what do you do with this information? Is it useful? Are there ways in which it could be dangerous? What do you guys think? Yeah, Bob.
It seems to me that it humanizes him.
Yeah.
And that seems to me to be a useful thing, because it's so easy to demonize him, and then he has nothing to do with us, because we're not demons. But if we're like, if he's human, like us, then he's us to some extent.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's great. I think that's perfect. Yeah.
And we are him.
And what?
And we are him.
And we are him.
I think that humanizing is good, and also that our actions, we may have the best of intentions and carry through things that we think are proper, and we're doing the right thing, and yet you really should know.
What do you think about the aftermath of this poem?
What do you think of what?
The aftermath.
Like what happened next?
Yeah.
That's a great question. What do you think?
I'm not sure. He eventually had to leave the man, probably. They stopped eventually.
Yeah, and eventually we still have the two stories that we do about Judas's death, right?
Grabbed his rope.
I think that's a great and brilliant question to ask, because you get to the end in this act of total caring and mercy, and yet we still have to return to the texts themselves that tell us that, you know, on the one hand, Judas killed himself, and so that maybe it's not such a happy ending, you know?
I don't know if we have to return to the text.
Okay.
Just open this up and move towards redemption. The line, held for nothing, is to me almost an epigram that you could put up on the walls, that grace and mercy is given without hope of getting something.
Yeah.
Or gospel. To me, that is taught in the gospel.
Yeah.
That you give without hope of recompense. And those three lines just held for nothing. I did it for no expectation. There was nothing that I could get back.
Yeah.
It's kind of dangerous, though, too. Let me just sort of end.
Yeah.
We should end with that comment. So kind of take it out. but it's dangerous in a way, too, because now we have to figure out somebody else to hate.
Who does?
Why?
Humans do.
Why?
Well, we want to do it. We want to have somebody that we can have be the bad guy.
We'll
hate Jezebel.
Well, I think, you know, Bob's right about that instinct, but to me, for me, the poem also becomes a way to look at who are the people that we hate right now? Who are the people that our country hates? And if we can practice writing about them or practice reading writing that works to humanize, that works to, I mean, in this 14-line poem alone, we get two new versions of this story, you know, the same story told twice. There could be, you know, this poem could continue in version after version of the same moment, the same thing, and that part of the salvation that we receive from texts like this isn't just seeing what happened to Judas, but that at some level, I think, we all participate in that salvation, and we get to start believing that maybe Judas wasn't so bad, that there was humanity there, that there was a new way to see his actions. So anyway, thank you all for coming and being so brilliant and